Absalom's rebellion, you may remember, took David by surprise. And as it had been a time of peace, David had no standing army with which to resist the rebellion or to quell the rebellion. And it seemed best to him and to his advisers that he, together with all his supporters, should flee from the capital city of Jerusalem, which thing he did, along with his wives and with his children. And he made his way towards the Mount of Olives. We're told in chapter 15 that he stopped at a place looking over the Kidron Valley, watching the march of the famous 600, as they were called, his own little army that passed by him, and we read of that at the end of chapter 15. The king's servants went before him, all his servants passed on, and all the Kerethites and the Pelethites and the Gittites, 600 men which came after him from Gath, passed on before the king. Chapter 15 and verse 18. And it was at this point, we're back in chapter 15 for a moment, that Ittai, a distinguished Philistine and perhaps a general, declared his absolute loyalty and support for David. Well, David then instructed Zadok the priest to return the sacred ark to Jerusalem, and then learns that Ahithophel, his trusted friend and advisor, is among the conspirators. And that must have come at a tremendous shock to David. We read in verse 31 of chapter 15, one told David, saying, Ahithophel is among the conspirators with Absalom. So what David did was this. First of all, he prayed, and that's recorded in verse 31 of chapter 15. I pray thee, turn the counsel of Ahithophel into foolishness. And having prayed and committed the matter to God, he then adopted a particular policy. Hushai, the Archite, then came to meet him. And this man had been an old friend and had been David's privy counsellor. And David suggested to Hushai that as he was getting on in years, that he should return to Jerusalem as a spy, so that he would be a mole, as it were, in the enemy's camp, and would be able to leak out information to David concerning the development of the rebellion, and also that being in Jerusalem and being a very wise advisor, proven over many years, he should do what he could to upset Ahithophel's plans and policies, and so bring his scheme to nothing. Now we can pick up the thread at that point, and I want to speak of three things tonight. The first is Ahithophel's counsel, and the second is Hushai's counsel, and the third is God's counsel. First of all, the counsel of Ahithophel, the counsel which David feared, because upon hearing that Ahithophel had turned his coat and had crossed the floor, as it were, was now on the enemy side, he asked God to turn this man's counsel to foolishness. Ahithophel's counsel. Now a word, just a brief word about Ahithophel himself. His name means brother of foolishness, which probably lies behind the words of David when he prays that God would turn the counsel of Ahithophel to foolishness. We've seen in the past that he was almost certainly grandfather to Bathsheba, and he had been estranged from David for some time. When Absalom began the rebellion, he calculated from the very beginning upon the support of Ahithophel. You remember how he went to Hebron, which was to be the place whence, from whence the rebellion would come, and we read there that Absalom sent for Ahithophel the Gilonite, David's counsellor, from his city, even from Gilo, while he offered sacrifices. Chapter 15 and verse 12. So something had happened by way of a breach in the relationship between David and this hitherto trusted friend. And when Absalom began his course of wickedness, he immediately requested the presence of Ahithophel, knowing, I would suggest, that he was alienated from David and that he would almost certainly align himself with Absalom. Now, he had been a trusted friend and a trusted counsellor, and it was a great disappointment to David to know that he joined the ranks of Absalom. There are two psalms which particularly refer to it. The 41st psalm in verse 9, where David says, "Yea, mine own familiar friend, in whom I trusted, which did eat of my bread, hath lifted up his heel against me." And then in chapter 55, and verse 13, "It was thou, a man mine equal, my guide, my acquaintance. We took sweet counsel together, and walked unto the house of God in company." If it was an enemy, he says, that reproached me, then I could have borne it. But it was thou, a man mine equal, my guide, and mine acquaintance. More than a friend, then, an advisor and a confidant. And now he'd become all this to Absalom. Absalom's friend, Absalom's counselor, Absalom's right-hand man. And there's no doubt that as the rebellion developed, Ahithophel became the mainspring of that rebellion, the great mind behind it, far more able in many ways than Absalom himself, as we shall see, but the great architect of the whole revolt. Now, soon after David and his followers lost sight of Jerusalem in their flight, Absalom marched from Hebron, where he gathered these people together, toward Jerusalem. The city, we find, was taken, as was the palace. And in one of the halls of the palace, a kind of cabinet met, a war cabinet, and it convened to determine the right course of action and how the rebellion could continue with good success. That's why we read in chapter 16 and verse 20 that Absalom says to Ahithophel, "Give counsel among you what we shall do." And Ahithophel gives further counsel in chapter 17, verse 1. And it was at this meeting of the rebel cabinet that Ahithophel, esteemed as the ablest man amongst them, was first asked by Absalom about what should be done, and about what was the best way forward. And Ahithophel's counsel, which is our concern tonight, contained within it two schemes. The first was, seize the royal harem. We read of that in chapter 16 and verse 21. Ahithophel said to Absalom, "Go in unto thy father's concubines." And the second was, pursue the fleeing king. Chapter 17, verse 1, "Let me now choose out 12,000 men, and I will arise and pursue after David this night." So there were the two schemes within Ahithophel's general counsel. Now let's think of them together for a moment. First of all, seize the royal harem. Now, sadly, in keeping with the polygamous custom of his day, that is, the custom of having more wives than one, David had secured several wives. Back in 1 Samuel chapter 25 and verse 42, having married Michal, Saul's daughter, we read that he then married Abigail, and she became his wife. 1 Samuel 25, 42. And verse 43 says, "David also took Ahinoam of Jezreel, and they were also both of them his wives." And matters went from bad to worse, because in 2 Samuel chapter 3, And verse 2, we read, "And unto David were sons born in Hebron. And his firstborn was Amnon of Ahinoam the Jezreelitess, and his second, Chileab of Abigail, the wife of Nabal the Carmelite, and the third, Absalom, the son of Maacah, the daughter of Talmai, king of Geshur, and the fourth, Adonijah, the son of Haggith, and the fifth, Shephatiah, the son of Abital, and the sixth, Ephraim, by Eglah, David's wife. These were born to David in Hebron." Now, this was David's weakness, and it's a blot upon his character. Why did he do it? I'm sure his besetting sin was involved here. He had a definite weakness in his spiritual life, but we must also remember, of course, that it was policy in those days. Mistaken policy, but nevertheless regarded as very shrewd policy. In order to make powerful allies and friends of surrounding kings, it was reckoned to be wisdom's way to take unto one their daughters, thus removing the possibility of an attack from them, for they would hardly attack one married to their own offspring. Well, of course, we have our Lord's words in Matthew 19 that it was not so at the beginning. And David suffered terribly throughout his life because of that failure to obey God's law. Now, when David fled from Jerusalem, he had left 10 of these women at Jerusalem. Ahithophel's counsel was seize the royal harem. That is, he advised Absalom to claim these poor women for himself, to sleep with them, and that this would be in Absalom's interests. Seize the royal harem. Now, it was evil advice, but it was exceedingly clever advice. And I want to bring out the cleverness of it just for a minute or two. By seizing the royal harem and taking these women unto himself, Absalom was thereby designated himself heir to the throne. The concubines, or the wives of a king, were tremendously important assets because of this political policy behind it. If another came and took the harem, it was tantamount to a claim to succession. If you look back in chapter 3 of this book and verse 7, we read, "Saul had a concubine whose name was Rizpah, the daughter of Aiah. And Ishbosheth said to Abner, wherefore hast thou gone in unto my father's concubine? And immediately Ishbosheth interpreted Abner's action as an attempt to seize the throne." Do you remember how Abner then left Ishbosheth in the lurch and turned to support David? But Ishbosheth was right. It was an action with tremendous significance. To take the king's concubine was really to take the king's place. So if Absalom wanted something really to show that he recognized himself as the natural successor to David, he couldn't do anything better than this. Secondly, by such an act, Absalom would appear totally committed to the rebellion. You see, it was the grossest insult which could be offered. And if there were doubts in anybody's mind as to Absalom's intention and the resolution of his heart, that doubt would be removed by this action. It was an unheard of outrage. And therefore it would sound signals in every place that Absalom meant business. It was a declaration of war. Thirdly, it would be an impressive publicity stunt. We know that even today, when a cabinet minister does something immoral, and somehow it gets out, Perhaps one paper carries it as the exclusive report. The next day, all the papers carry it. It spreads throughout the kingdom. What Absalom needed at this time was that this shouldn't be a local revolt, but a national revolt against David. Now, in the absence of the media as we know it, one of the best ways to secure the widest possible publicity for the rebellion was to do such a terrible deed as this, to take David's wives and have sexual relations with them. The news of it would shock the nation. It would also show that a rebellion had indeed taken place, a very serious one, in Hebron. Fourthly, some satisfaction would come to Ahithophel personally. You remember he was the grandfather of Bathsheba, who had been wronged in David's fall into sin. Now what David had done in the matter of Bathsheba was that he took another man's wife, and he brought great bitterness, ultimately death, to Uriah, her husband. And Ahithophel, bearing this resentment these many years, and determining now at last to find revenge, he resolved on a way to make David taste the very bitterness which he had made others taste. What do you think it feels like, David, for your wives to be taken from you? What do you think it felt like for Uriah to have his wife taken from him? And so there was bitterness in Ahithophel's heart, and no small satisfaction at this particular plan. Fifthly, there must have been those in the nation who hadn't yet made up their minds who to support. That's always the case, isn't it, in a rebellion or in a revolt. There could be no wavering now. It wasn't a question of one man rising as another man gradually falls away. Absalom's action, as counseled by Ahithophel, clearly drew the line between the two sides. And people had to choose whom they would support. Ahithophel, who'd now staked his claim, or David, whose wives these women were. So it really made for immediate decision. Sixthly, it would be a great shot in the arm for Absalom's supporters in this sense, that it would secure far greater ferocity in battle. Because it now appeared clear to everyone that if Absalom lost, and if the rebels were routed, there would be no hope of mercy. This hideous act and crime had been committed. And the supporters of Absalom, knowing, therefore, that if they lost the rebellion, they would be executed, therefore fought with fury. Not only to see Absalom on the throne, but to save their own skins. And finally, Ahithophel, by this policy, made it possible that there would be no future reconciliation between David and Absalom. Now, David, we know, had a weakness so far as his children were concerned. And you remember how, after the murder of Amnon, let Absalom flee to Geshur. Then he let him come back to Jerusalem, but he wouldn't see him. And finally, he would see him. And Ahithophel feared that that might happen again, that the day would come when king and usurper would be reconciled and the usurper would be pardoned. If that happened, where would Ahithophel be? What would be his fate? Well, now that David and Absalom were reconciled, both would turn upon Ahithophel and put him certainly to death. So it was in Ahithophel's interests to get Absalom to do something which was unpardonable. And that's what he did. Seize the royal harem, he said. You see how shrewd it was. We're not saying for one moment that this man was an idiot. He was one of the shrewdest, most subtle men of which Scripture has any record. The second scheme in his counsel was this: pursue the fleeing king. Chapter 17 and verse 1. Now that night, after David had fled There was no thought of sleep, neither for David, who was in flight, nor for Absalom, who was now in Jerusalem. There had to be further consultation because the cabinet of war had to come up with some idea of how David could be seized and put out of the way so as to leave the throne vacant for Absalom. Now it's Ahithophel who makes the proposal here in chapter 17:1, and his proposal is this: to take a select body of 12,000 men and follow the king that very night, and overtaking him and his handful of supporters, to take the life of the king. And once the king was removed in death, the support for him would evaporate, and probably David's supporters would then see the issue clearly and return to Absalom. Well, the proposal commended itself at first, and I want you to see that this scheme was as clever and as devious as the last. What can be said for it? Well, let's look at this second scheme. The first thing that strikes me about it is that what Ahithophel was counseling was prompt action. At a time when the tide was obviously turning. Absalom had staked his claim. He had with him men of great ability. David had fled the city, which to any observer looked like abdication. And if not, certainly looked as if David was no longer sure of loyalty in the capital. Now, says Ahithophel, never has the time been riper, and never will the time be better. What I advise is immediate action. That was good advice. The second thing about it is this, that at the time when Ahithophel gave this advice, David was only a short distance from Jerusalem. We know that one of the places that he reached, mentioned back in chapter 15, was only 4 miles out of the city. He'd probably gone a little farther, somewhere between 5 to 8 miles, perhaps, from Jerusalem. He had been in flight for half a day. He couldn't have gone far. He was on foot. He had women and children with him. He couldn't be very far. Ahithophel was quite right. Go after him now. He's within reach. You won't weary yourself. You won't tire yourself. It'll not be a long and arduous journey. It won't be a demanding search to try and find his whereabouts. We know that there's only one way out from the Mount of Olives onto the road to Jericho. We know exactly where he will be. I counsel that you rise this night and pursue after him. The third thing in favour of this scheme was that it was likely that the king and his band would be weary. It was now past evening, turning to night. Verse 2 of chapter 17 says of Absalom that he said, I will come upon him whilst he is weary and weak-handed. In other words, he will be tired with the rapid march. It was rapid, even with the wives and with the children, as rapid as could be, because David feared for his life. And being rapid, it would have meant that David and his men were tired at the end of the day. Furthermore, they hadn't had the time to get provisions, so they were hungry. Now, says Ahithophel, in God's name, seize them now. They're at their weakest, they're most vulnerable. They'll become our prey without any effort on our part. The fourth thing that strikes me as very clever here is that there would be an element of surprise. You see, Ahithophel is quite right. At the end of verse 1 there, I will arise and pursue after David this night. It's often the strategy in warfare, isn't it, to attack by night. How often during the last war, attacks were made by night and were wonderfully successful, because that wasn't when the enemy expected the attack to come. David will expect us to wait for dawn. But it must be tonight, in the darkness. And if we seize upon him in the darkness, he and his men will be overwhelmed in panic, and they will certainly be scattered. Fifth consideration is this, that there was, the conditions were ripe. You see, there was tremendous excitement in the capital city Absalom had entered in. He had had no resistance. He'd entered into the capital. He'd actually entered into the king's quarters of the palace. There had been no resistance to that. The whole city was excited at recent developments, many not knowing what was happening, but feeling that Absalom was now rising to the throne. Absalom's supporters, who'd been plotting this some time now, were already, they were baying for blood. And the blood of these men was fever high. They were ready. They were ready to make Absalom's position clear. So the very climate had advantage. Ahithophel therefore says, no. The sixth thing is this, that it was advantageous for yet another reason, that David had no time to rally his troops, and he had no time to prepare a strategy of defense. Why, the man was in flight. He was still in flight. Before sympathizers from north and south and east and west gather to David to help him out of this present crisis, before he can sit down with trusted counselors and commanders and work out how to defend his interests, now is the time to strike. Strike now, and we shall undoubtedly win the day. And of course he was right. And finally, it held out the possibility of a bloodless war. Because what Ahithophel wanted to do, in verse 2 it's made clear, I will smite the king only. That was his scheme. I will smite the king only. In other words, he'd only need these men. Mind you, 12,000 of them. But he wouldn't have a civil war of it. The intention of this particular expedition was to signal out King David and smite him so that he dies. And once David is dead, then his adherents and supporters would have nothing more to fight for, and they would surrender. And that would win the kingdom to Absalom. Now, Absalom was a carnal man, and it didn't have to be long before he was very much inclined to the first scheme, going in to David's concubines. There was no problem with that. That satisfied his lust, and there was no great risk involved or danger which might ensue from that. So he was happy to go along with that. But when Ahithophel gave this second scheme, although, as I say, it was exceedingly clever, and if it had been implemented, would have undoubtedly been successful, Absalom had a few doubts. The first was this, that Ahithophel, if this scheme was put into operation, would have all the glory of it. He would lead the 12,000 men. Where do I come in? Remember, Absalom was a proud man. He just settled in to have relations with David's wives, and being the carnal man that he was, why don't we spend the night in the city and enjoy the spoils that we've already gained? Tomorrow we'll be a bit stronger and we'll be able to go after David, but let's not be too war-minded. After all, life is more than battle. There's pleasure too. That weighed with him. Perhaps Ahithophel's last note of I will take the king only struck home to Absalom's heart. What was he advocating? Patricide. The actual killing of his father. Now, of course, this might have been assumed hitherto, but it was never so stark a reality as when Ahithophel spelt it out. Whatever made him a little bit uneasy caused him to ask counsel from Hushai. Then said Absalom, verse 5, call now Hushai the Archite also, and let us hear likewise what he saith. Now Hushai had been an old friend of David's. And in chapter 15, verse 37, we read, excuse me, so Hushai, David's friend, came into the city, and Absalom came into Jerusalem. The word friend there doesn't just indicate affection, but it indicates that this man was similar to Ahithophel. He was the king's advisor too. Now, there at the end of chapter 15, and you'll remember it, Hushai met David as he was coming out of Jerusalem and he had his clothes torn and he looked very distressed for David and was going with him. And David says, if you come with me, you're an old man, you'll be a burden to me. Go back to Jerusalem. Send me word of anything significant that happens there and do what you can to upset Ahithophel's purposes. And so he was sent back. And chapter 16 tells us what happened when Absalom came into the city. Verse 15, and Absalom and all the people, the men of Israel, came to Jerusalem, and Ahithophel with him. Came to pass, when Hushai the Archite, David's friend, was come unto Absalom, that Hushai said unto Absalom, God save the king. And Absalom said to Hushai, is this thy kindness to a friend? Why wentest thou not with thy friend? He was known to be a man so close to David that when Absalom saw him in Jerusalem with him, he was taken aback and filled with surprise. What about your friend David? Is this your kindness to him, he says? Why did you not go with your friend? And Absalom answered, Hushai answered Absalom in a very, very ambiguous kind of way. He said, it's very clever here, really. He said when he came in, God save the king. He didn't say, God save King Absalom. God save the king. And when asked this question in verse 17, Hushai said to Absalom, nay, but whom the Lord and this people and all the men of Israel choose, his will I be, and with him will I abide. He didn't say, I'll abide with you, Absalom. He said, whom the Lord will choose. Absalom understood that to be him. Hushai understood it to be David. So there was an economy here with words and considerable ambiguity. But Hushai deceived Absalom into thinking that he was now a supporter of the rebellion. And what was his advice? Well, Hushai's counsel was basically to wait in order to assemble the hosts of Israel, and then when people had been gathered from Dan to Beersheba, at one tremendous army, to pursue David, completely overwhelm him, and such would be the magnitude of the force against him, there would be no resistance, and very little effort on their part to achieve their ends. He's a very clever fellow, this Hushai, because he didn't believe in his own counsel here. He didn't believe in it at all. He was playing for time. If he can postpone the pursuit so that Absalom will be minded to gather his army from the four quarters of the land, it will take time. It'll give David more time to get away from the city. It'll give David more time to gather together soldiers, faithful men and true, from all parts of the kingdom. It will give David time to devise a real strategy of defense. It'll give David time to see the commotion in the kingdom dying somewhat, and people perhaps coming to see a little bit more reason, the passion beginning to die down. It would all be in the interests of David. And it was very cleverly presented, because Absalom says to Hushai, what do you think? And verse 7, Hushai said unto Absalom, the counsel that Ahithophel hath given is not good at this time. Very careful not to offend, you see. He's usually very good, Ahithophel. I'm very impressed usually with what Ahithophel says. He always seems to be right on the ball. But this time I fear it's not such good advice as it has been. So it's a sort of compliment to Ahithophel that normally he's very wise, but an implication that this time he's forgotten something, which doesn't immediately get the backup of Ahithophel, nor does it immediately alienate Absalom from him. And then he proceeds. And Hushai's counsel is exceedingly clever too. First of all, he stresses the need to be cautious. For, said Hushai, thou knowest thy father and his men, the mighty men. Now, there was a certain appeal in that. What Hushai was really saying is, look, you've done so well. You started off in Hebron with 200 men. You gathered your forces. You broke through into Jerusalem. You've taken the king's palace. You're almost king within the capital. You've got the king's harem. You've got massive support in the kingdom. Why venture all those gains on an immediate attack at night, the issue of which can never be sure, because we've only got 12,000 with us? Everything you have won could be lost. Absalom, caution is the better part of valor. Well, that rang a few notes, didn't it? Struck a few chords. Then he says, take into account that David's men are approved men of courage and strength. They be mighty men, he says, verse 8. And they're not exceedingly strong on me as David himself is. Remember the bear, the lion, when he was a young man? Remember his victory over the Philistines? Remember his battles with all the surrounding nations so that he subdued the kingdoms unto him? He's a mighty man, and he's trained his men to be mighty. He has a trained army, the standing army of Israel. Your supporters are not trained together, to work together, to coordinate together. And what is more, they will be at this present time chafed in their minds. Verse 8, the meaning is that they'll be inflamed with resentment and with rage that you've instigated the rebellion. Now, if you get strength combined with rage, there's a fearful enemy out there, Absalom. David and his men will be like a bear robbed of her cubs, tremendously strong and exceedingly ferocious. He's really making old Absalom tremble in his shoes. It's not going to be easy, Absalom. You're up against tremendous odds even now. Think about the character of David and the ability of his mighty men and their anger. Thirdly, he says, Ahithophel's counsel, we take the king only. And do you think that is going to be that possible? My father is a man of war, verse 8, and will not lodge with the people. David is a strategist. And being so, it's unlikely that he will be in the camp, because as a man of war, he might suspect treachery even amongst his own people. And there's always the danger of a surprise attack. So he will probably sleep outside the camp. Now, Absalom, how are you going to find him? You'll find the camp easy enough, with the women and the children and the straggling supporters of David. But how will you find King David? Fourthly, he says this, behold, verse 9, he is now in some pit or in some other place. Remember, Absalom, that when David was pursued by Saul in his younger years, how he was well acquainted with rocky hiding places. And out there somewhere, he and his men may be in a cave of a rock. You go after him with your 12,000, and the likelihood is that you'll be ambushed. He'll come at you from all sides, from the caves all around you. It'll be a disaster. If he does find such a place, and if he does ambush you, verse 9 in the middle, and it shall come to pass when some of them be overthrown at the first, that whosoever heareth it will say, there's a slaughter among the people that follow Absalom. If he makes an ambush from these rocky caves, and some of your men die in the ambush, the word will quickly spread, and this will strike terror into the rest of the army, and your cause will be lost. Your army will turn their backs, and they will run. Now, the reputation of David for valor will give credibility to that report, and the people will be very willing to believe it. He that is valiant, verse 10, whose heart is as the heart of a lion, shall utterly melt, for all Israel knoweth that thy father is a mighty man, and they which be with him are valiant men. So it's not a case of, oh, we won't listen to that rumor, it can't be true. They know David's ability and his skill. He's got a record. He's a proven champion. It won't take much to convince your supporters that they've been routed. So I tell you what I advise, says Hushai. Verse 11, I counsel that all Israel be generally gathered unto thee, from Dan even to Beersheba, as the sand that is on the sea for multitude. In other words, that you don't go with a mere 12,000, that you go with your hundreds of thousands, so as to avoid all risk of casualty and avoid all risk of defeat. If you go with tens of thousands, then you can go to battle in your own person, verse 11, because you'll be well defended. There'll be no possibility that you'll be killed with such an army. So that means you could lead Absalom, you with the long hair, you with the great pride of life, you who didn't want to follow Ahithophel's scheme because you felt he was taking too much glory for himself, that he would lead the 12,000, do it my way, and you could go out. And whether, therefore, you meet David in an open place, verse 12, or whether you meet him in a city, verse 13, he'll be utterly defeated. He won't stand a chance. Ahithophel has met his match, hasn't he? We were impressed at the guile behind Ahithophel's counsel. We're even more impressed by the craftiness used for God and his king behind the counsel of Hushai. And it seemed to Absalom to be right. He could be independent of Ahithophel. He could indulge himself for a night with these women in the excess of lust. And he could avoid anything that was dangerous or risky to his life. And he was a coward at heart. So Hushai seemed to have the edge. Which brings me to this final point. God's counsel. Back in chapter 15 and verse 31, David had said, O Lord, I pray thee, turn the counsel of Ahithophel to foolishness. God had determined to do that, according to chapter 17:14, for the Lord had appointed to defeat the good counsel of Ahithophel, to the intent that he might bring evil upon Absalom. So, working now through Ahithophel's counsel and through Hushai's counsel, God's counsel is worked out. Now, the first part of Ahithophel's counsel was to take the harem. God's counsel was that he should be allowed to do that. And he did allow him to do it. And I'll tell you why he allowed him to do it. Because of 2 Samuel 12 and verses 11 and 12. After David sinned with Bathsheba, Nathan said, Behold, I will raise up evil against thee out of thine own house, and I will take thy wives before thine eyes and give them unto thy neighbor, and he shall lie with thy wives in the sight of the sun, for thou didst it secretly, but I will do this thing before all Israel and before the sun. That was the judgment upon David's adultery. God therefore allowed the first scheme of Ahithophel to remain intact and to be fulfilled. And the judgment would come upon David. But he disallowed the second scheme to go after David that night with 12,000. Because had that scheme been followed, it would have undoubtedly been successful. David would have been overtaken without any choice of position, without gathered troops. And God had counseled that David should not be removed from the throne. He had counseled that David should be king. So he overturned the counsel of Ahithophel, the second scheme of that counsel, by putting it into the heart of Absalom to ask Hushai what he thought. Hushai's scheme was accepted, Ahithophel's wasn't. David was therefore secured. And as to Hushai's counsel, what did that mean? Hushai said, Leave it. Gather your men. Let Absalom go forth at the head of these men and overwhelm him like the dew on dry ground. Then there won't be any risk, there won't be any disaster, there won't be any regret. That's my counsel. Wait. Deliberate device, of course, in David's favor. And God's counsel was that Hushai's counsel should be followed. And what did that mean? It meant three things. It meant, first of all, that Ahithophel would receive his just deserts, because perceiving that his good counsel had been rejected and Hushai's mistaken policy had been adopted, Ahithophel, man that he was, foresaw that Absalom had made a fatal mistake. The rebellion would never survive it. David would be restored. Verse 23, when Ahithophel saw the counsel was not followed, he saddled his ass, arose, got him home to his house, to his city, and put his household in order, and hanged himself and died, and was buried in the sepulchre of his father. He fell into the pit which he had dug for himself. And God's counsel was that Hushai's counsel should be followed so that Ahithophel could be punished. Secondly, God counseled that Hushai's counsel should be followed because it meant the death of Absalom, which we shall come across later, just a chapter or two later on. He does go forth to battle. He gets caught up in the tree, you remember, with his hair. Joab comes along and pierces him through his heart. If Ahithophel's counsel had been followed, Ahithophel would have gone forth leading the army. God's counsel was, that must be rejected. Hushai's counsel must be followed so that Absalom will lead the army, because Absalom must be punished. And thirdly, God counseled that Hushai's counsel must be the one that determines the course of events so that the rebellion could be overthrown. Ahithophel's counsel had been better, would have secured success. Hushai's counsel guaranteed Absalom's defeat. God would have the rebellion quashed. Ahithophel's death, Absalom's death, the rebellion removed from the kingdom, David restored to the capital, set upon his throne, and reigning according to the law of God. Remarkable, isn't it? It reminds me of a proverb. There be many devices in the heart of a man, but the counsel of the Lord, that shall stand. And you know, in our own personal lives, it doesn't matter what men think evil against us, and however people might plot to do us hurt, if we be the Lord's, and we love him, and are the called of God, everything shall work for good, and the counsel of Ahithophel shall be overturned. And as a church, we are aware of satanic conspiracy, maybe, against everything we hold dear. We may be aware of human conspiracy to undermine the interests of this church. I tell you, the counsel of Ahithophel will be turned to foolishness, because no weapon that is formed against thee shall prosper. And it's not the evil plans of men, but it's the sovereign purpose of God which guarantees a future for his people, and for the cause of reformation, and for the doctrines of the Word of God. That's why I chose earlier that 33rd Psalm. God doth the counsel bring to naught, which heathen folk do take, and what the people do devise of none effect doth make. All but the counsel of the Lord doth stand for ever sure, and of his heart the purposes from age to age endure. Amen.